This is a beautiful cover.
It is.
The distinguished American scholar and historian Daniel J. Boorstin was with the Library of Congress as its director for 12 years and is now librarian emeritus. In his many writings, he has examined the history of his own country as an experiment and as a phenomenon, as a power, and in great detail as a democracy. He has, in two huge recent works, examined the history of man's discovery and the history of man's creativity. Those two books, The Discoverers, which came out in 1983, and The Creators, which came out in 1992, are the subject of Dr. Boorstin's most recent work. I'm Susan McGinnis for Conversations. It's a pleasure and a privilege to welcome Dr. Boorstin to the studio. Thank you for joining us.
I'm delighted to be here.
I want to reach back. A book called Democracy and Its Discontents, in its first chapter, looked at a single word, the word to communicate.
Yes.
You argued in this first chapter that we have lost the truth of this word. We've lost the original meaning and its power and come away from it. Can you tell me where that original meaning comes from and how we've lost our way?
Well, I think the word communicate is related to community. And I think, if I'm not mistaken, originally the word community described people who paid the same taxes. Communis, but more recently it's had other meanings attached to it. I think the, there is a, I remember Lehrer, Tom Lehrer did a record called That Was the Year That Was. Do you remember?
Yes.
Do you remember that?
Yes, in the 60s.
And he, I remember one thing particularly in that record, which I thought was a great success. I'm sorry he didn't continue and do more. And he remarked that it was a time when parents were complaining they couldn't communicate with their children and teachers couldn't communicate with their pupils. And he said that if people couldn't communicate, the least they ought to be able to do is to shut up. And I think there was something in that. I think we talk an awful lot about communication, but I think the important thing is community. The sense of sharing, of being in the same kind of enterprise. And in my works, which you mentioned, The Americans, the three-volume study of American civilization, which was rounded off, quite a number of years ago, that's one of the main themes, community. And I think the history of this state and the history of the United States as a whole illustrates the importance of community. In fact, one of the remarkable features of American history, by contrast with that of many of the countries in Western Europe, for example, is that in this country, in much of the development of the country, we had communities before there were governments. People moved west across the continent. They went in wagon trains, and some of them went individually, and they came together in communities did not have formal governments. Were no part of the United States, actually. They had a sense of sharing problems and concerns and hopes and aspirations. And that's how they formed their states. And if they finally had governments, the governments were to celebrate and take notice of communities that already existed. For example, when people moved west in wagon trains across the continent, they organized themselves into mini governments, and they even had constitutions to recognize that they were a kind of community. And I was raised in Tulsa, Oklahoma. Oklahoma, when I was there, it was very conscious of having been the 46th state, of having come into the Union rather late. And people were very proud of Oklahoma. My father was one of the builders of that town of Tulsa, and he was a booster. And that sense of community, of having had a part in building that city, is kind of feeling that people couldn't have had in in the cities of Western Europe, in Sheffield or Birmingham or Oxford or Cambridge or in any of the cities of Paris, because those were built long before.
Is this hand-built aspect of America part of what leads you to call it such an optimistic country? That we came out into the wilderness and built ourselves this cathedral of a democracy?
Well, I must emphasize, of course, here in Alaska, that one of the latest and most brilliant examples of community, a community before government, and of the building of communities within the memory of living people is Alaska. Who would have imagined that in this grand, snowy wilderness, it would have been possible to build a prosperous state? Forward-looking and cultivated, and I think it's most impressive. I think it's amazing, and that makes this state a symbol of what's been going on all over the lower states, building a nation. One way of describing the United States is that we're about 250 million people in search of a nation. That search, which goes on here all the time in Alaska, and which we see more refreshingly here because it is such a recent state, reminds us that we're in quest. That it's not like the countries of Western Europe, which were reinforcing the traditions of ancient peoples, but rather we're trying to make something new, and we're trying to figure out what it is that we're making.
Are we still like the pioneers coming across the country, making up the democracy as we go along?
Well, yes, I think we must be. I think we were very lucky that the framers of our Constitution were able to provide a plan for experiment, a federal plan, of which the existence of this state is a very good example, and that they developed what many other constitutions in earlier European history, the history of the Western culture, did not allow opportunity for amendment. And one of the great features, one of the great visions of the framers of the Constitution in 1787, as they met in Philadelphia, was to imagine that their work was not perfect. It would have to be amended and make it possible, but not too easy to amend it. Mm-hmm. And they provided what later, partly because of the vision of Jefferson, who saw the nation as expanding into an empire of liberties, he called it, what I would call an add a state plan. They imagined that it would be possible to add new states, and that the people who founded their communities and wanted to have governments and become part of the larger nation would set up their own kind of constitution within the framework of the federal constitution. That was quite a vision. It was an amazing thing for them to realize that what they were doing was not perfect, mm-hmm. would have to grow and expand.
Where did that sense come from? Did it come from having to wrest themselves away from King George, or was it a vision?
Well, if we take Jefferson, Thomas Jefferson, who is one of my idols, and whom we celebrate this year, you know, this is the 250th anniversary of the birth of Jefferson. He was born in 1743. Jefferson was preoccupied with the idea of the novelty of America. He thought it was wonderful that there were so many new things here. And that sense of novelty was expressed in the only book he ever wrote, called The Notes on Virginia. Which he produced in response to the request, the rather prosaic request of the French legate in Philadelphia to make a list of all the things that were unique and interesting about America. So he produced this work, which is very listy, you know, and statistical. And he describes the peculiarities of the plants and the animals and the geography and the geology in a very refreshing, almost naive way. And one of the reasons he did that, actually, was that at that time in Western Europe, especially in France, where people were worshiping the goddess, as they called it, of reason, they believed that the French naturalist Buffon, who was a very respectable scientist at the time, believed that all animals and plants, including man, developed less well in the New World than in the Old. And it was partly to refute that that misconception, and I hope it's a misconception, I think it is anyway, that Jefferson provided statistics taking the same species of quadrupeds in Europe and in America, deer and otter and bear, and he showed that that the same species were heavier, were larger and heavier here than they were in their European counterparts. There is a very amusing example of a more witty refutation of that European misconception, that European chauvinism, in the story of Franklin, who also was plagued by this accusation. You know, there was an Abbe Raynal who took up Buffon's ideas and said, "By especially man who is not developed in America, there haven't been any American poets or any American scientists or anything." And one evening, Franklin was at having dinner with some elegant Parisian scientists and aristocrats. And one of these people, Abbe Raynal, was there, and the Abbe Raynal said, "Well, you know, it's a pity that all these, that mankind and all the other plants and animals disintegrate in America." And Franklin said, "Let's test it. Let's all stand up and see who's bigger." And Franklin, who was a short man, as a matter of fact, he was not tall at all, towered over all of these French aristocrats and refuted the Buffon thesis in a rather witty way.
This is Dr. Daniel Boorstin. He comes to us as an author of the American Trilogy, which he mentioned earlier, the final book of that series of three, one for him, the Pulitzer Prize. The other two have both been lauded as a remarkable look at this country. His most recent book is called The Creators, published in 1992 by Random House. It is the second of a series, the first called The Discoverers. In these two books, he traces the history of human discovery and human creativity. Dr. Daniel J. Boorstin with us on Conversations. I'm Susan McGinnis. I want to ask you about something in particular. You asserted at one point that America is a great empirical success, but it has never evolved a great political philosophy. Is that in part true because the founders of this nation, the architects and later the maintenance people of this nation, took from great philosophies to create this nation, or is it something different altogether?
Well, we've just been talking about Jefferson.
Yes.
And Jefferson was, I would call Jefferson the apostle of experience, because at his age, the French statesmen and thinkers believed in the goddess of reason and in what they call the rights of man. Jefferson was more interested in the rights of Englishmen, as a matter of fact. We forget that he was a lawyer. His belief in the ways of protecting the rights of people was very much rooted in the idea of institutions. Institutions are the product of history, and history is what creates rights and embodies them in institutions. And this was shown in his own writings, as a matter of fact. When I think he spoke for all of us when he did that, and some rather curious works. One book which was not, which people don't remember much, is the little pamphlet that made him famous, called A Summary View of the Rights of British America. And in this little booklet, he argued that the American colonists were entitled to have all the rights of self-government. Because the Britons themselves, many, 1,000 years before, had immigrated to Britain from some other North European countries. And he said that when they immigrated, their former rulers didn't assert powers over them. So it certainly was not reasonable that the King of England should assert rights over the Americans. So he argued from ancient history, which had built institutions. And then the Declaration of Independence, of course, which is very familiar. But it's out of focus, I think, because what we remember about the Declaration is the preamble, you know, when in the course of human events and so on. What we do not think about enough is the substance of the document. It was a legal document, which really is a list, as he calls it, a history of the usurpations and crimes of the King of England. So for him, the Declaration of Independence was an affirmation mm-hmm. of the rights of Americans as Englishmen, which they inherited from the English common law and the British Constitution. So we make a mistake. It's rather technical, and it's although every 4th of July, as a matter of fact, Ruth and I have a party at our house outside Washington. We have a place in the country which we call Mount Vernon View because we face Mount Vernon. And there in the site of Mount Vernon, we have a friend, recently it's been some justice of the Supreme Court, who reads aloud the Declaration of Independence, the whole thing, including these legal rights. And it's a very readable document, but it is in substance somewhat technical, and it affirms the importance of the rights that people have won through their institutions. Now, that mix, you see, of the belief that history has forged rights for people, together with a belief in the novelty of America, the novelty of the American experience, which Jefferson saw which he embodied in the Notes on Virginia, which I've mentioned, also in the Lewis and Clark expedition, which he organized and sent west, had his private secretary, Meriwether Lewis, we'd hired for that reason, take a group of explorers west all the way across the continent, which added more probably to human knowledge of this earth than any expedition that had ever been made. And incidentally, it provided an American Indian heroine, Sacagawea, you know, who guided the Lewis and Clark expedition. So, but Jefferson believed in the novelty of experience. But he thought that we must learn from history and from our institutions, not forget that this had all been accumulated. And he thought that the Frenchmen, who thought they could make everything anew and junk history and junk institutions and use the guillotine and mm-hmm. instead of the Constitution, traditional Constitution, that he thought they were misguided.
Is there any loss, then, that this nation has never developed a great political philosophy, that we are imperial?
Well, I think that's the flip side of the other side of the of our success in building decent liberal institutions, that we have not tried to be governed by a dogma, by an ideology. And that's what I was suggesting. The Declaration of Independence itself, which is the birth certificate of our country, is really a certificate of institutions. I think that our success in developing representative government, and we've been pretty successful on the whole, we've had our weaknesses and our failings, but on the whole we've been remarkably successful, is partly because we have not tried to be ruled by an ideology. And a symptom of this is that we've never produced a great work of political theory in the United States. And Jefferson, who is our most prominent political thinker, was not an ideologue. He never produced a work of political theory. And the Declaration of Independence is a very good example of that.
So in many ways, that's what keeps us flexible and tolerant, that we don't have a single religious view or a single political philosophy to guide us.
It's the politics of experience, I think, mm-hmm. and not of ideology. And if you live in Washington, and Ruth and I, my wife and I have lived in Washington now for over 20 years, and we enjoy life in Washington. One of the reasons is that there's a tradition of civility. Mm. We came from a university community. And one of the things that professors are able to do is to affirm the right. They can take a position and affirm it. And they don't have to take action on it, you see. But in Washington, that's not the case. Mm. In Washington, the members of Congress come together and they have to take action on something. They have to move in some direction. They can't simply affirm the right. And one of the things that interested us most when we came to Washington, as I say, we'd come from a great university, where people sometimes would cross the street in order not to have to encounter someone who disagreed with them about the Vietnam War or about some other issue. In Washington, we would go out to dinner and there would be Democrats and Republicans who had opposed each other on the floor of Congress that very same day, and who treated each other with civility. And that tradition of civility is one of the great successes, I think, of American political life. We don't normally find American congressmen throwing inkwells at each other and vituperating, as which has been the case in many of the sessions of the Chamber of Deputies in France or the deputies in Italy. The European traditions of ideology are inclined to lead representatives to accuse others of ill will and even call them traitors when they're simply disagreeing on matters of policy. Mm-hmm. And we've been fortunate in developing this tradition of civility, and I think it's most important.
How does the rise of instant news and the rise of instant examination of news affect that tradition of civility, do you think? We can hear about the latest events in Washington or around the world in every 15 minutes if we have cable on our televisions all day long on the radio news.
Well, I think that one of the main consequences, unfortunate consequences, is what I would call myopia. Mm-hmm. You know, myopia is nearsightedness, where you see the nearby things out of proportion.
Nothing at distance.
And it's a chronological myopia. We are inclined to see the most recent events, the events of yesterday and the day before and this morning, and not put them in the proper perspective of centuries, the centuries in which our nation has been built. And I think that the media, the press, and especially television, the very medium that we're on today, tends to focus more on what happens just now, when our lives have been shaped by the works of people over centuries. And I think the other thing is that it's a tendency to be interested in information. You know, there's a difference between knowledge and information. The one thing which is notable is that knowledge tends to be orderly and tends to endure. Information has to be displaced. A newspaper that's just as interesting tomorrow as it is today would not be a very successful newspaper. The news has to be displaceive. But a book is something that has to continue to be interesting at least 6 months or a year after it's produced, otherwise it would disappoint its publishers and wouldn't earn its way.
And knowledge builds on itself, right?
Knowledge is cumulative.
Yes.
Information is displaceive. And I've suggested that, you know, there was a pioneer economic thinker by the name of Gresham who developed a law called Gresham's Law. I wonder if you ever heard of it. It was a law that bad money drives out good. And if there are two different kinds of currency in a community, currency that is valid and solid and that which is inflated, the inflated currency will drive out the good currency. And I think that's what we have a kind of Gresham's Law now, and with information tends to drive out knowledge. People are so preoccupied with the latest thing that they have read that they lose sight of the of what is cumulative. And of course, the front page of a newspaper is a very good example of what we mean by information. Mm-hmm. It's miscellaneous in little bits and pieces. Most of it's going to be displaced tomorrow. But that's not true of a book. A book has to have chapters, and the chapters have to have some orderly relation to each other, and they have to continue to be interesting even a year or more from now.
Is the antidote to the information age to read and reflect?
Well, yes, I would say, with due respect to this medium and to your job, which I wouldn't want to, but we're not purposely try to displace.
No offense taken.
I think if people have a choice, that generally the best media for them to focus on would be the media that takes some time to produce their results. That is, I think, for example, books are more valuable to read than magazines. Magazines probably more valuable than newspapers. Mm-hmm. And newspapers, if I may say so, are often even more valuable than television news, which has to be instantaneous. It has to be produced by people who don't have a chance to reflect on it. So I think that people should read more books. That would be my prescription for what I would call a knowledgeable, not well-informed. We speak of well-informed citizens, but what we need is knowledgeable citizens. Mm-hmm. And you become a knowledgeable citizen by reading and reflecting, and not necessarily by reading this morning's newspaper or by taking it too seriously.
I don't want to ask the historian to be a prophet, but if we are moving deeper and more deeply into an information age, is the state of knowledge at threat, or are there balancing forces in this fast-moving country?
Well, I think it's most important, and that's what I've devoted my last two major books that I've written, The Discoverers and The Creators, were an effort to write a kind of history of human fulfillment, not in wars and empires, but in fulfillment of man's possibilities. I think that we must recognize, and the talk of so-called multiculturalism has been menacing in this regard, we must recognize that we all have a great heritage. And one of the great things about American culture is that it's given us the opportunity to share that heritage, regardless of where we come from, whether our ancestors happen to have been born here, as is the case of many of the people in Alaska and in other parts of the United States, or whether they've come as immigrants, as my grandparents did, that we have an opportunity in this country, which has never been given before to people, to share the great culture of the Western Europe, and to learn a new language, English, which is new to most of the people who've come here, to share the wisdom of the Bible and of Shakespeare and of all the great poets in the English language. This is a great privilege that we have, and we can share. And that the emphasis on sharing is something that I would plead for at this moment. And when we find so many people reaching out in efforts that threaten to balkanize our culture, we want to avoid that, surely. And that's what I've aimed at in the Discoverers and the Creators, to remind us of what that heritage is and how we can share it.
The Creators is subtitled The History of Heroes of the Imagination. This is Daniel Boorstin's latest book, published by Random House in 1992. Our guest today on Conversations, Dr. Daniel J. Boorstin. You have said, I believe I'm saying this right, that the study of creativity, or creativity itself, is the study of specificity, that we become not generalized, not mongrelized, but specific and celebrating our differences when we turn to creativity. Is that accurate?
Well, I don't know. I think that there is one of the differences between the discoverers and the creators, but the discoverers is about all the sciences, is that science is cumulative. One test of the significance of a work of science, as often it's been said, is how many earlier works it makes obsolete. That's not true in the arts, you see. The arts are every artist invents an artist. And the arts are additive. We don't read Ptolemy for geography or astronomy anymore, but we still enjoy the Greek sculpture and the Greek architecture, and that is something that we should remember. That is that the artist Michelangelo is not made obsolete by Picasso. On the contrary, we understand things about Michelangelo we never would have understood so well before. Before there was a Picasso. And I think that difference, one of the differences is, of course, that the sciences tend to impress us with our own importance and our powers over the world. Uh-huh. They nourish a pride of feeling how great mankind is. But in the case of the arts, we are more inclined to be inspired by awe.
I was just thinking.
How inexplicable it is that mankind has been able to do all the great works of architecture and sculpture and painting and music. And that awe is something that I think we should share, because those works are all produced by fellow human beings.
You wrote that this is another difference, perhaps, between the discoveries of science and the discoveries of art. That when Copernicus made his greatest discovery, it shook up the world in which he lived and forced it to discard some of its beliefs, some of its myths. Is that another difference? Is that something that science does that art will never do, art will never displace?
Well, That's true in one sense, of course, that great works of science, as I've suggested, are works that make earlier works obsolete, that shake you up. And of course, the Copernicus, the findings of Copernicus that this Earth was not at the center of the universe or in the center of the solar system, shook people up and had some serious consequences. The kind of shaking up that we get from works of art is rather different. As I say, it's not displacive. It doesn't lead you to respect the earlier artist less, but it opens new avenues of thinking, new ways of discovery, things about yourself and about the world which you never imagined. So I think one of the purposes of this work, of the discoverers and the creators, is to show how complementary can be the works of science and of the arts. They're not in conflict, but they're people at the different kinds of enterprises. Mm-hmm. The discoverer is trying to know what's going on out there or in here. The creator is, as I suggest, a hero of the imagination, adding something, seeing things in a new way, and which would never have been seen without that person, that man or that woman.
Do these two works in some ways explore, on the one hand, the intellect of humanity, and on the other, the spirit of humanity? And is that why we need them both?
Well, I don't think intellect and spirit can be separated quite that way. I think that it's, I would rather think of they're both quests for fulfillment, for discovering the possibilities. And one way of putting it would be that in the sciences there is progress. Yes. Newton displaced Ptolemy, and Einstein partly displaces Newton. But we might say then that the sciences show progress. Well, I would almost say that they only show progress, but the arts show possibilities. The arts reveal aspects of the world and of us which were unimaginable before. And they're not, because they're not cumulative, they're not displacive, and they're always adding something. And each new artist helps us, impresses us with the uniqueness of earlier artists too.
Dr. Daniel Boorstin is our guest today on Conversations. He was educated first at Harvard, later as a Rhodes Scholar in Cambridge, and did his postgraduate work at the Inner Temple in London. He is an attorney. You stood for the bar both in England and in the United States, is that right?
Yes, I'm afraid I must correct you.
Please.
Rhodes Scholars don't go to Cambridge. Rhodes Scholars go to Oxford.
Go to Oxford. Oh, that
and
is
And only
my...
to Oxford.
Thank you.
Although, and of course, there's a considerable rivalry between Oxford and Cambridge, and I did later go to Cambridge as a Pitt professor and became a fellow of Trinity College there. But the Oxford experience is a very awakening experience. It was for me, and I think has been for many other Rhodes Scholars. It expressed the vision of a rather strange man, Cecil Rhodes,
sure.
who was a person of limited views and something of what I would call him a racist, I think, today. But on the other hand, he had a vision that he thought it would be possible by providing an endowment, bringing together people from what he thought of then as the Anglo-Saxon races, if they came to Oxford and got to know each other and discovered the beauties of English life and the importance of sports, because he thought that was very important in emphasizing the team spirit, leadership, that these people might form a community of world leaders. He was rather, it is sometimes said that the original number of scholarships he provided for the United States, there were 26 to be, and it was said that he thought that, it may be apocryphal, but it was said that he wanted to have 26 scholars, two from each of the 13 colonies. This was in the late 19th century. And that was one of the things he thought was great about America, that we had been a British colony. But the Rhodes Scholarship is an extraordinary and remarkable creation, far exceeding the vision of its founder, which of course is itself an illustration of the of a kind of creativity that yes. we should be aware of. The great works of institutions and of the arts show a capacity to exceed the imagination of their founders. Mm-hmm. And the Rhodes Scholars, I think Rhodes Scholarship has been a very successful enterprise. At least I found it a very world-opening experience. I think many others have too.
When you talk about a world-opening experience, what led you to desire to be a historian? What created that desire for you?
Well, when I was an undergraduate, I always liked to read, of course, and liked to read biography. But when I was an undergraduate at Harvard, I had a very inspiring tutor by the name of F.O. Matheson, who wrote about American literature. And I wrote my honors thesis there on Edward Gibbon. Have you ever heard of Gibbon, the man who wrote The Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire? Well, I read that work and reread it, and that became an inspiration to me. And it reminded me of certain things. In the first place, that history was not a story of ideologies, but of people. And that's what Gibbon is so successful in depicting, people. That also that great history must be great literature. And we read Gibbon today because he wrote literature. And that became one of my ambitions, was to try to write history that would be literature, that would live, because the only works of history that live are those that live as literature, that have a structure and a drama and excitement and a vividness to them. And that's, of course, there are special problems that the historian faces in trying to create that drama. If you just stop and think for a moment, because you'll see that if you're writing fiction, you're free to make the story yourself, and the reader never knows whether the person you're describing is going to be a hero or a villain. But and so you have a mastery of the material, which is rather remarkable. But if you write history, you don't have that freedom, because people know how it turned out. So that as a historian, you have to work within the limits of the facts, and yet create drama, suspense over how it came to turn out that way. That is the challenge of the historian, I think, and one that I find interesting and enlivening. It's fun.
Let me tell people about some of your books, so if they have not read, they can make notes, and if they have read some but not all, they can go back to the library or to the bookstore. The most recent book that we have been talking about, The Creators, A History of Heroes of the Imagination. It is the companion to The Discoverers, the publisher of The Creators in 1992, Random House. The Discoverers, a Book of the Month Club male selection and bestseller, was published in 1983. It's been translated into over 20 languages. Prior to that, the trilogy, The Americans, examined the colonial experience, the national experience, and the democratic experience. Its first volume took the Bancroft Prize, the second, the Parkman Prize, and the last, the Pulitzer Prize, also other awards. A book I have found lovely, although Dr. Boorstin says it is out of print and is not a significant book. I found it most significant, and it's at the library in Fairbanks. You'll find Democracy and Its Discontents, Reflections on Everyday America, a book as relevant, I think, in 1993 as it must have been in 1972 when first published. This is Dr. Daniel J. Boorstin. I'm your host for Conversations, Susan McGinnis. You've described history as a cautionary science. Can you tell us what that means from your perspective?
Well, if I may add a note. Please. To your list of my books, there was one book you didn't mention, which is not irrelevant to the question you've
actually
just now asked.
Not mentioned.
That was
a couple,
book called The Image.
Yes.
And the theme of The Image, which is a guide to pseudo events in America, that was a book that that introduced the phrase pseudo-event into our language, and has been into other languages too, because it's been widely translated. But the theme of that book, which may suggest some things that could be said about history as a cautionary science, is an anecdote of a mother who's pushing a baby carriage in a park, and she meets a friend. The friend says, "My, that's a beautiful baby you have there." And the mother says, "That's nothing. You should see his photograph." Well, that is the clue to one of the problems that we face, which I describe in that book as the image, which is because of what I describe as the graphic revolution, the opportunity for making so many images, not only through photography, but now through the electronic media, through movies and television, it creates confusion as to what is real and what is contrived. The interview being, of course, a very good example. But when I speak of history as a cautionary science, I'm saying several things. First, that I don't believe in the simplifications that people give us or try to give us about history, and the Marxian simplification of the history as the result of materialist forces, primarily or almost exclusively materialist forces. I don't believe in history as the oscillation of as a time of the back and forth movement between different tendencies. I believe in history as the study of people, the story of people and their idiosyncrasies, their possibilities, their hopes, their frustrations, and that any effort to imprison human possibilities in ideology, in simplification, is misleading. And that the study of history then can make us wary of the ideologues. And I think that the recent events in Eastern Europe are a very good example of it. There had been many prophets, of course. Khrushchev and others had predicted that the communists would bury democracy, and others had various theories about how communism would disintegrate. But nobody had figured out that it would collapse in the way it would, that the ideology would collapse. And I think people are still rather inclined to believe that ideology has disappeared, which I don't think so at all. I mean, ideologies don't disappear quite so simply. But they become subterranean, or they become assimilated into other ways of thinking. So I think that to think of history as a cautionary science is both to entice us to learn about history as a human epic, and also to make us wary of those who would seduce us by their simplifications.
So once again, we have to stay flexible, attune ourselves to the unexpected,
that's
not
right.
Predict by that's history.
Right. Well, that's, I would say, if I may, well, one of the axioms of history as a cautionary science is that the only certainty in history is the unexpected.
What do we do? What's the danger, rather, when we look too much at current events? You spoke of events in Eastern Europe, the collapse of communism. When we look at what we see on the news and decide that means that there's a turning point. You mentioned a moment ago that the collapse of communism doesn't necessarily mean a turn in another direction, because it has its history behind it.
Well, countries are governed by institutions, and I think one of the great problems that the Russian people will have if they want to move toward liberal, decent society is in their lack of institutions. They don't have the framework within which to construct a liberal society.
Because every time there's a revolution, they demolish what was there?
Well, they have a tradition of oppression and slavery and anti-Semitism, which is going to be hard for them to shrug off. And their attitude toward foreigners, is understandable, I suppose, not justifiable, but certainly understandable, because for millennia they were invaded by the Mongols, and then they were invaded by the French. Napoleon burned Moscow, and then they were invaded by the German Nazis, the Germans, in the Second World War, which produced a death toll of over 20 million. 20 million people died in that war. So when the Russians see a foreigner, they think of an invader. Mm-hmm. That's not our situation in the United States. We're all foreigners. That's how the country's been built.
So this is another caution to people, say, in America, looking at people, say, in Russia, that we have to remember their history will in part govern, certainly influence their future.
That's right.
There are no quick fixes.
You mustn't expect the impossible of them. But you know, there's another aspect of this too, in relation, which is relevant to the people who are concerned with the weaknesses of our society, and who often don't see anything else. And that is that totalitarian countries, oppressive governments, always tend to exaggerate their virtues. Free societies, in their very nature, tend to exaggerate their vices, their weaknesses. Mm-hmm. And I think if we had to choose between those two tendencies, it's much safer to exaggerate your vices than to exaggerate your virtues. And I think that's something to remember, that the hallmark of a free society is that its view of itself is more unfavorable, perhaps, than the objective situation would justify. But that opportunity for free unfavorable judgment and free criticism is what makes us free.
Is one of the costs of freedom being imperfect and always hating it?
Well, I don't know about that, but I think it's a kind of a belief which Jefferson, whom we referred to earlier, and whose 250th birthday we celebrate this year, believed in the happy variety of minds. What makes life interesting is that variety. Yeah. And an enforced homogeneity, a government by ideology, prevents us from enjoying the possibilities of all of us, of the whole human race. And that's what we want to try to explore, and which the American experience has given us an opportunity for. And I think, and here in Alaska, we have a special opportunity to see aspects of it which have never been seen elsewhere.
In America, it seems, at the end of the 20th century, instead of celebrating our diversity, we see all the different voices as clamorous, noisome. There are African-American voices, and there are voices of fundamentalists, political fundamentalists and religious fundamentalists. Oh. And everyone seems to kind of be grappling for space in the union. We tend to, I think, in this country, look at that as
problematic. Well, I think it's a menace. I think, obviously, we're all minorities in this country. And I think that if anyone has the prestige of being a minority, it should be everybody. I don't believe there are African Americans. I don't believe there is such a thing. They're only Americans. And I'm not a Polish or a Jewish American. There are no Italian Americans. We're all Americans. And the hyphenated American, the person whom we characterize as being only partly American, has that concept has no place in my vision of the possibilities of America.
That's where the problem is, that we see them as partly American rather than fully?
No, but we should not see ourselves that way either.
I
believe there's been an American humanism which has emerged from the distinctive experience of this country, the opportunity which people have discovered to learn the language and become part of the culture, of Western culture, which is, I think, a wonderful and fulfilling thing for all of us, for everybody. Not to have religious wars. We're one of the few countries in the world that's never had a religious war, and I hope we never do. A place where people can come and acquire new ways and become parts of new communities. And that, I think, is the greatness of our country, and we don't want to lose it in the petty chauvinisms and hatreds which arise from the emphasis on our separateness and an insistence on the importance of roots. The greatness of being an American is the opportunity to develop new roots. My ancestors came over. My grandparents were immigrants, but we developed new roots in Tulsa, Oklahoma, and people
so can different.
Develop. A lot of people are developing new roots right here in Alaska. Were you born in Alaska?
No.
All right. Well, you're a very good example of the opportunity of people to join new communities. Mm-hmm. And I hope we'll continue to do that and insist on our community, the community of opportunities to become American mm-hmm. and to go in common search.
Are you optimistic about this nation? There's a great many people who would say we're in a downward spiral. We've lost American values. We've lost an ethical base.
No, I'm optimistic because I'm optimistic for the human race. And I think that this country has given us an opportunity to discover possibilities in the human race, the possibility of ceasing to be narrow provincial inhabitants of Africa or Europe or Asia, and to join in a common quest for our common humanity, for an American humanism.
What's the role of this country? We talk of ourselves and we are spoken of as the last great remaining superpower. Having influenced the world over. Is that a precipitous place, a dangerous place for us?
Well, I think it's the power of example, which is what Jefferson, who I've mentioned before, and Lincoln and others have insisted on, not the power of power. And I think that's a lesson to remember, both internally, the groups who seek power in our country are seeking something which they should not seek, which no particular group should seek. We should all seek the community of our country, our common interests, and try to define those. I think that's the same thing is true of our relations to the world. The greatness of our country in the world has not been as a great power, but as a great example. What Lincoln called the last great hope of Earth. There's no conceit in that, but it's just an opportunity.
Then you counsel restraint. Do you also counsel restraint in being an example to the world? I'm thinking that if we perceive democracy as working well, we might tend to think that other countries should be democratic.
Well, I'm very wary of our effort to impose institutions on other people. I don't think it will. I think it's futile, and I think that in the long run corrupts both those who try to impose it and those on whom it's imposed. I think people must find their own way, and that's what we found in this country, and I think we must do the same, give the same compliment to other people, that they have give them the same opportunity to find their way, even if we don't always sympathize with it.
Mm-hmm. And this is another way in which And this is another way in which human expression will enrich the human experience. That is to say that the Japanese will always, one hopes, live differently than Americans will live.
Well, I hope so. Yes, the world would not be a very interesting place if we were all exactly alike and had exactly the same institutions. And it's of course not possible, because institutions, as I've suggested, are a product of history, and history is something which is varied.
Mm-hmm. We're talking today with Dr. Daniel Boorstin on Conversations. A couple more notes. He has been granted numerous honorary degrees, also the Phi Beta Kappa's Distinguished Service to the Humanities Award and the Charles Frankel Prize of the National Endowment for the Humanities. In 1989, he was awarded the National Book Award for Distinguished Contributions to American Letters. Dr. Daniel Boorstin served the Library of Congress as its director for 12 years, from 1975 to 1987, and now serves as the Librarian of Congress Emeritus. We have not mentioned his distinguished time as a professor of history at the University of Chicago for 25 years at that university, where he was last the Preston and Sterling Wharton Distinguished Service Professor of History. He also taught at Harvard, at Radcliffe, at Harvard Law School, and at Swarthmore before going to the University of Chicago, and was an active lecturer in countries as distinct as as France, Australia, Fiji, Iceland, Pakistan between the 1950s and the 1970s. I'm Susan McGinnis, and this is Conversations. Are you working on anything at present?
Yes, I am. If you're a writer and consider it your vocation, you can't abdicate. I continue to be a writer, and I'm working on something which I think will be a companion to the discoverers and the creators, and I hope you'll like it.
Its topic?
Pardon?
Its topic?
Well, I'm not at liberty to disclose it at the moment, but I hope in due course you will hear about it, and I hope that you'll enjoy it.
We will have to wait. Dr. Daniel Boorstin, thank you very much for this hour in Conversations.
Thank you. Thank you, Susan. It was a pleasure to be with you.
Thank you. I'm Susan McGinnis. This is Conversations, and I hope you'll join me again next week.